Natural Living with Gary Null, exploring the nature and politics of medicine, health, nutrition, and the environment. And now your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, and I'd like to welcome you to the program. Today, we are beginning an in-depth, comprehensive series, what I would foresee to be the most comprehensive program ever done in American media on AIDS. This program will probably take close to at least 20 shows to do. I'll be doing one per week. It's based upon over 15 years of comprehensive review of the scientific literature, interviewing thousands upon thousands of individuals. I have tried as best I can to maintain my own political and emotional neutrality, allowing the voices of those who have held responsible dissident points of view to have a forum. All of the mainstream or orthodox scientific literature has been reviewed and referenced, because at times you will see that some of the strongest points that the critics are making concerning the war on AIDS, the information is coming from the scientific journals of the mainstream point of view. What is the truth? Said jesting Pilate, and would not stay for an answer. That's from Francis Bacon of O Truth. In April 1984, there was a historic press conference which Time magazine introduced as, quote, High Noon in Bethesda, Maryland. It was at this press conference that Dr. Robert Gallo from the National Cancer Institute announced his discovery that a recently identified virus caused AIDS. Staying with Time account, let's look at the form of this conference. Was it a sober issuing of a scientific statement given to a sterile government office? Well, not quite. The meeting was held in a French restaurant. It did not consist of the reading of a scientific paper, but of the kind of contest one would more likely associate with game shows than quality medicine. Gallo was facing off against a rival, Dr. James Curran from the Center for Disease Control, which was also searching for the cause of AIDS. In February 1985, a report by the Federal Office of Technology Assessment on the Public Health Service response to AIDS would indicate that the bickering between these two agencies was instrumental in derailing and delaying progress in responding to the disease. Dr. Curran gave Gallo 205 anonymous blood samples, some from patients with AIDS, some from healthy donors, some from people sick with other diseases. Gallo had previously tested the samples, checking to see if they contained the virus he was touting as the culprit in AIDS. Presumably, if traces of the virus were found in and only in the AIDS patients, he would have given some proof of his contention that the virus causative role. As Kern read off the designation of the samples, M5, M28, and so forth, Gallo responded with either positive or negative. At the end, he correctly identified nearly all of them. It seemed, at least to the journals present, that Gallo had proven his point. He had proven something else, too. Serious science, affecting millions of lives, was no longer a thing of the laboratory, but of the grandstand. The article brought out a number of other significant phenomena whose implications we need to assess. For one, although this was the first official presentation of Gallo's results, the conclusions would appear in four forthcoming articles in Science. Quote, word of the discovery already began to leak out, unquote. The previous week, through advanced copies of the papers underhandedly obtained by New Scientist magazine, also, as word got around, other scientists vied for the spotlight. As Time magazine put it, quote, scientists bicker over who first discovered the virus, unquote. Dr. Luc Montagnier of the Pasteur Institute in France said a virus he and his group had discovered previously closely resembled the virus Gallo identified. Lastly, Gallo and his group were not resting on their laurels, but racing ahead to develop, quote, an accurate and inexpensive blood screening test. There are both foreshadowings and symbols in this account. The last two items, the claims of the Pasteur Institute and the promise of a blood test, presage events to come. Montagnier's remarks concerning the originality of Galileo's discovery foretell a colossal lawsuit brought by the French government 3 years later. The question we put as to whether Galileo's discovery did not so much innocently mirror certain French results. Everyone acknowledged that the French had already discovered and published a paper on LAV, a retrovirus said to cause AIDS, as use of falsified data, concealing how dependent his discovery was on French advances. The French lawsuit, though, turned more upon the French-American dispute over the origin of the blood tests, which would be developed later. Since no matter how careful governments are of their scientists' prestige, they are usually more concerned about their country's financial weatherall. The blood tests, which both the French and Gallo would quickly develop, would net the U.S. government millions, and Gallo himself a cool $800,000 right off the bat. By government mandate, these tests would have to be used by U.S. blood banks, which had proved shockingly negligent in screening blood, even as cases of AIDS by transfusion mounted. This is what the French lawsuit would center on. Who discovered the blood test? Who deserved the monetary awards that poured in from selling the blood test? Also appearing in the article are a number of symbolic counters that suggest unsettling facts about modern science, not only in the grandstanding we have mentioned, but in location of the meeting and the fact that the press conference preceded scientific publication. A key point brought forward by Schultz is that the timing was dependent upon political agendas. The announcement had to make the Reagan administration look good, so it was delayed so higher-ups such as Margaret Heckler, chief of the Department of Health and Human Services, could be present. Yet plans to perfectly orchestrate the event were foiled in the press conference held precipitously when, according to Schultz, a reporter from New Scientist, who had lied and said he would hold the news till after the papers were published, rushed into print. Meanwhile, an AIDS researcher in San Francisco inadvertently blurted out news of the discovery to a radio interviewer. Thus, Gallo's presentation was hastily scheduled to head off further reporting on the issue, which would steal the thunder from his own staging. Of course, it may be thought that though it is unseemly that a scientific statement has to be slated in accordance with the whims of the media, this hardly affects the discovery itself. True enough, but other aspects of the media fanfare do tend to strike more deeply. Consider for a moment what science has traditionally been about, and contrast that to how the media conceives and publishes the enterprise. The media imagines every scientific breakthrough is analogous to Archimedes' discovery of principles of volume displacement. The Greek was sitting in a tub at the public baths when the idea hit him. He ran out naked into the streets near the Acropolis and yelled Eureka. The law was immediately accepted and has not been disputed since. Perhaps very simple laws of physical nature were discovered that way, self-evident, once pronounced and accepted by one and all. But the findings of modern research are not so easily and cheaply won. What happens, in the best case, is that a team of scientists publish the results of an experiment. Then this experiment is tested by other interested workers in the field. On the other hand, the experiment is carefully reduplicated in other laboratories to see if it was replicatable. Different scientists question the interpretation of the original team results. Even if the results the first group found were repeatable, this does not mean the interpretation arrived at is logically or empirically sound. This description should alert us to the fact that whatever the ultimate validity of Gallo's research, at his press conference, it would appear that he threw out conventional scientific decorum in favor of sideshow antics. Of course, there was validation of a sort, but not the sort described where peer testing goes on in a straightforward, sober manner. When Kern presents his samples so Gallo can pass judgment, we have the kind of testing we might have expected from a mind reader, like the great Wazoo, who tells a naive, dumbfounded matron what color hanky she had in her purse. But what about the interpretation of this information? Here the weakness of Gallo's claims are even more patent. He has found a virus that is discovered in AIDS patients. Is it a necessarily logical step to say this causes the disease? Obviously not. Logically, its presence may be a byproduct of another cause, even of another as yet unidentified virus. What would you think of a policeman who arrested a man for murder because he kept finding him at the scene of the crime? Of course, it looks suspicious, but it is not proof. To be fair, Gallo and his co-researchers' original publication presented the causal role of HIV as hypothetical, if strongly indicated, while it was Time magazine with its report that, quote, a breakthrough has finally been made in the understanding of the deadly AIDS epidemic, so that we now know the face of the enemy, and unquote. Nothing was further from the truth. Time magazine erred and has never acknowledged that error. Other media outlets jumped to the same conclusions, and they were all wrong. However, as we will show later, scientist, even Gallo himself, soon followed suit, taking the correlation as proof of the definitive causal role of the virus, as if it were letting the media determine the nuances of a scientific debate. Moreover, there is one further symbol lurking in the article, the bistro. It was, quote, a small French restaurant with hanging baskets and beaming ceiling, unquote. Why pick such a place for the announcement of a significant scientific discovery? In our society, French restaurants are viewed as the epitome of chic and money dining. If we temporarily narrow our evaluation of American medicine simply to look at the question of inequality in recruitment and treatment, we may say that it's a sad fact that the healthcare system has been geared so the elite can benefit. Since early in the century, quote, opportunities for non-wealthy and non-white medical students who have been prevalent before this time almost vanished, unquote. Although the situation may have improved a little in the past few years, since the beginning of the 20th century, the increasing cost of medical schools combined with the decreasing number of such schools and their ever more stringent entrance requirements has closed into most minority and poor applicants. Moreover, given that physicians tend to be drawn from the upper middle class, medical research has been inclined to center on disease of the well-off. According to complaints voiced by dissidents at the American Medical Association's conventions, quote, medicine has focused on the disease of the rich and the established, cancer, heart disease, and stroke, and ignored the diseases of the poor, such as malnutrition and high infant mortality, unquote. This is the dirty little secret behind our government and the media's criminal neglect of the AIDS crisis in its developmental years. So as ably chronicled by Randy Schultz and in The Band Played On, U.S. medicine has long had two modalities, one for treating white, middle-class heterosexuals, and one reserved for others, the poor and the minority. So when the cry went out that a disease was ravaging gay males and IV drug users, it was met by blanket silence and indifference from President Reagan, government bureaucrats, and most scientists and journalists, who felt they could safely ignore the situation, which did not affect people with clout. Eventually, political uproar, along with the principal stance of lone researchers, forced the government and the media to turn attention to the disease. Yet it might be conjectured that giving the news briefing in a Tony restaurant was a way of reasserting that handling of it would stay in the elite establishment's crown control. One thing has been left out of the Time story, by the way, which is what had suddenly accelerated the snail's pace of research into the disease that had gone on during the first years of its spread. what overthrew the establishment's expectations that if they ignored the disease, it would go away was an unexpected boomerang effect. The excluded set about getting included for gay males who saw themselves endangered yet ignored, this might take the root, as it did in San Francisco, of deeply political activism, which forced elected officials beholden to gay votes to put the city on the forefront of government funding of prevention, treatment, and research, or, as in New York City, brought about the creation of a totally alternative system of health care centered around the gay men's health crisis, drawing its funding from private donors and its dedicated workers from volunteers. Now, as an aside, we may note that the species of irony the disease sometimes poses for gay males. Belonging to the homosexual minority differs from that of belonging to such groups as racial minorities, in that it's quite feasible to pass as a straight in everyday life, thus avoiding discrimination. Paul Popham, for instance, the president of the Gay Men's Health Crisis at that time, was at first wary of the word gay in the organization's name because he was passing it, passing in his straight job. So learning one had AIDS could do a double blow to a man who was passing, both revealing he had a disease that quickly led to death and tending to tear down his straight facade. Since if word got out that he was sick with AIDS, his cover was blown. Paradoxically, it may well be that AIDS' potential for destroying masks and thus indicating both the pretense and undependability of these masks played a part in galvanizing closeted gay males like Popham to embrace their gay identity more fully and become strong fighters in the battle against the disease. Now, I don't know how many readers or how many listeners have drawn all these implications from the Time magazine article. Certainly anyone regarding it today, even if he or she overlooked many of the symbols and foreshadowings, would note the outstanding positive and negative prongs, that is, the coming together and splitting apart that have occurred since that day. By the latter, the splitting apart, I mean that the seeming consensus that existed at the moment in which everyone agreed HIV was the virus, then called HTLV, was at the bottom of the disease, and its activities and a sound blood test to detect it were just around the corner, no longer exist. The first part of this discussion today will measure how such dogma, though still held by the Orthodox, has come to be shaken to its core. To preview the assertion at the Bethesda Conference that HIV is the cause of AIDS will be one of the first doctrines I evaluate. And as you will see, that there is a lack of scientific credibility, and that's becoming increasingly evident. No matter how much the medical establishment, the government health agencies, and the media declare it infallible and true, it is not. The dogma laid down since 1984 is that HIV infection leads to AIDS and so on to death. If the causative role of HIV is doubted, then it will immediately follow that the purported cures which attack the virus, such as the use of toxic drugs, including AZT, become unsupportable. Further, the social campaign to, in response to the disease may be invalidated. Take the recommendations that we give clean needles to drug addicts because stopping infection with HIV is more important than discouraging addiction to dangerous drugs. However, if HIV is not the main culprit, this recommendation falls to the ground. The first half of my whole investigative reporting series, whose dimensions will be given in more detail momentarily and in subsequent programs, will run through many of the championed ideas of the establishment, such as that AIDS originated in and spreads like wildfire throughout Africa, that it can be heterosexually transmitted, it has astronomically increased in the United States over the last decade, and show that, brought to the bar of objective science, they are found wanting, not true. This will be balanced against the coming together, which in the Time article was indicated by the work of the teams of scientific researchers on both sides of the Atlantic, as well as by the many unmentioned gay activists that prodded the government and researchers to get on the stick. And I will present the evidence in a way that I will set up the argument and then dismantle it. This is the part of my program that I'm most excited by because I feel it is here that the solutions reside for combating AIDS. What moved me to do this investigation over this 14-year, 15-year period was not an urge for lashing the rogues and clowns of modern establishment science, though there is a place for that. I've done this research because I see hope for AIDS patients, though I will begin by casting a cold eye on the inflated claims of much recent research. The second part of my report over the next 10 weeks will offer alternative positions on the origin of AIDS. If any of these alternative views are correct, then treatment deriving from them will be more successful and tend to have happier results than those derived from the faulty analysis. This is where the hope comes in. The last portion of my report will present three alternative ways of treating AIDS. They have had phenomenal results in keeping AIDS patients alive and well and in complete remission. It is wanting to communicate to the concern these valuable treatments that offer people hope and are strongly, strongly grounded in good science. I've chosen to do this report just as Charles Dickens wrote to David Copperfield, sometimes in the first person. Like Dickens, this is more of a rhetorical than a factual convenience. Of course, I've written large portions over the last 15 years on the topic, and many of you might have read some of those articles or seen some of the documentaries. This will be adding to all that and taking what I had originally done and updating it and bringing out the newest of the information on it. Knowledge is power, was the cry of Francis Bacon, an Elizabethan lawyer, diplomat, and thinker. And he is credited with being one of the first people in the West to urge thinkers to turn away from speculating about God and metaphysics and towards scientific queries seeking to understand the nature of the world. These studies, he felt, should be conducted by doing experiments on materials, not solely by using pens to scratch on paper. In vain, he urged Queen Elizabeth and her successor, King James, to devote some of the royal treasury to fostering science because he felt the more people knew, the more they could enhance human life. There are two reasons to invoke Bacon here today. The first is this. One of his contributions, which is more contemporary relevance than many of his other thoughts, since most of his ideas, such as the need for government funding of science, lost force by being so thoroughly incorporated into current practice, which his study of what made people unprepared to think objectively. Finding his ideas were commonly greeted with scorn and incomprehension, he went to work to see why so few people were willing to look rationally at his proposals and ended up cataloging four types of blocks. At the time, he was showing how these blocks, which he called idols, prevented people from setting aside religious speculations on nature so they could adapt a scientific view. The curious situation I would like to reveal in representing his four idols is that in our age, these generic obstacles to freer thought have become central building blocks for modern science. At least establishment science, which is hindered by undue conformism. The second reason to mention this antique writer is that the intent and scope of his book, The Advancement of Learning, so closely matches so many more progressive people today. There, Bacon argued that for current work in science, little of it though there was to go forward, it would help if there was a general summation of current knowledge. In advancement, he proceeds through all current disciplines assessively, that is, rating them both as to whether they adequately encompass the field and whether the knowledge they did contain was sound. In his view, it was too often the case that ideas that had been around a long time were believed not because of their truth, but their pedigree. Bacon states that it is a general but erroneous prejudice that of former opinions and sex, after variety and examination, the best hath still prevailed and suppressed the rest. Which is to say, whether ideas, an idea is current, most of the closet, well, what he said was, he was looking at the past and saying that don't be prejudiced by what is in the closet. So according to this misconception, there is no reason to go back over the ideas that were discussed before orthodoxy was installed. If a man should begin the labor of a new search, he were but like to light on somewhat formerly rejected and by rejection correctly brought into oblivion. That's his own writings. So what he was saying back then is what I could see today. We like to think that science just started today, that thinking only started today. Not true. There have been minds that have set us on some interesting paths earlier on, and he was simply one of them. Now let's get down to the business of it. I'm Gary Knoll, and let's take a look at the scientist testifying against the current AIDS hypothesis, the preliminary thoughts, how the media and medical establishment support their beliefs. First, the media blitz. To the classically trained scientist, it is galling that Gallo and his fellow celebrity scientists involved in the AIDS debate seem to publicize their findings in the media before subjecting them to the normal processes of scientific review and discussion. Philip Johnson has commented that AIDS research has to be distinguished from ordinary science. He says, quote, "Its basic premise was established at a press conference and never subjected to the kind of critical scrutiny that ordinarily protects the scientific community from endorsing a catastrophic error," unquote. The point is made more strongly by another author. By announcing his theory to the media without providing any evidence, Gallo had violated rules of scientific process. Researchers must first publish evidence for a theory or a hypothesis in a medical or scientific journal documenting the research or experiments that were used to construct it. The hypothesis is then debated by other experts, and attempts are made to duplicate the original experiments and confirm the original findings. Any new theory must stand up to this debate and scrutiny before it can be considered a viable hypothesis. And any new hypothesis must be confirmed by successful experiments before it can be considered a fact. Three researchers writing in the San Diego Union-Tribune concur, saying the media's decision to blame AIDS on HIV virus in 1984 could not have been scientific. Quote, "For at that time, no scientific papers had been published and the normal critical procedures of the scientific community had not been allowed to operate," unquote. Just because AIDS appeared as a new plague, which would have terrifying repercussions, did not have to mean, but as it turned out, did mean that people would be so in need of assurance that preliminary findings would be accepted as received wisdom, a party line would be immediately developed, and a pack mentality would reign among respected scientists, doctors, and researchers. The first step in the media-driven side of the AIDS discussion was the abandonment of probability. Overnight, the word probable ceased to exist, and it became dogma, literally engraved in stone. Stephen Epstein did a content analysis of seven major scientific journals from 1984 to 1986, looking at their citations of the seminal 1984 article by Gallo, where it was hypothesized, speculated, that HIV was probably responsible for AIDS. He divided the references between those that said the Gallo article made a qualified claim about HIV's causal role, which in truth the article did, stating the evidence was not conclusive, and those that say the article's claims is unqualified, that is, there is no doubt about the virus's causal role. And Epstein's findings are shocking. Only 3% of the 1984 articles that cited Gallo did so in conjunction with unqualified claims about the virus being the cause. 58% of them cited Gallo's to support qualified claims. The rest did not touch on this subject and cited him for other reasons. By the following year, the percentage citing Gallo to make unqualified claims had jumped to 25%. By 1986, 62% of the articles cited Gallo to make unqualified claims, and only 22% did so in conjunction with qualified claims. What this means is, in just lay language, that you read the New York Times, the Post, or the, whatever paper you read, and if it says that we have discovered the cure of something or discovered the cause of something, you don't have any doubts in your mind. You say, good, we're glad that they discovered it. But we're not talking about lay newspapers. We're talking about the most respected scientific journals in the world did not do their homework. They accepted Gallo's pronouncement that HIV was the cause of AIDS without looking at his original work to see that there was no proof. None. There was no proof. It was only a hypothesis. It was only speculative. Now, if our best scientific journals don't question a press conference at a restaurant on the most important public health issue of this century, then all the newspapers are going to follow what these other scientific articles appearing say. So it starts off as a lie, and everyone builds on the lie until they make it the truth. After qualifications to the claim are silently liquidated, comes the establishment of dogma, partly kept in place because alternatives are not represented. Mark Garish Tolan compared the mindset of prevailing to that of the Soviet communism. He said, people believe that HIV causes AIDS for the same reason folks who lived in the Soviet Union thought communism was wonderful. They weren't given a frame of reference, and any dissenting opinions were kept out of the media. Soviet truth, like that produced by the dominant media, gains acceptance not because it is so plausible, but because it is repeated ad infinitum like a mantra. Unquote. The average scientist, unless directly involved in AIDS research, does not have the time or energy to carefully study all the controversies in scientific literature. This is certainly excusable and understandable. However, what is culpable is moving from an acknowledgement of one's limited knowledge to an unquestioning acceptance of the current opinion simply because, quote, everybody believes it, unquote. This, ladies and gentlemen, is the herd mentality. The media and the madness of science led by herds. I'm Gary Nall, and it's time for a station identification break. Back in a moment to continue.